Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The looming state budget deficit is estimated to fall somewhere between $6 billion and $8 billion by this time next year. And what are state lawmakers doing about it? Today, six of them, three legislators from each party, will convene the first meeting of the Budget Planning and Management Commission. It's a body that was formed nearly a year ago. What's been the holdup? What's the deadline? We're going to talk about that this segment. To our listeners, do you have an idea about the state budget? Give us a call or email us and be specific. The more specific you are, the better your chances of being heard. We've invited Ohio Public Radio Statehouse correspondent Bill Cohen back to the show for a primer on this commission and what we can expect from lawmakers in coming months. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you.
We've known about this impending budget doom in Ohio for more than a year, as evidenced, like I said before, by the creation of the Budget Planning and Management Commission. Why haven't they met until today?
Well, if you were a state legislator in Ohio, would you want to tip your hand on your solution to this budget mess before you have to face the voters in a re-election bid this November? Not too many legislators want to do that. The choices they've got to solving a budget hole that's, as you point out, up to $8 billion, it's just staggering options, and none of them are very popular. You got higher taxes. You got massive spending cuts. I guess you could sell off the Ohio Turnpike or the state lottery for a one-time big amount of cash, but you'd be selling off kind of long-term gains there. And then you've got kind of the fourth approach. You might call it Santa Claus. That's where you ask the feds for another huge bailout like the one we got last time around. So those are the four options. None of them are real all that popular with a lot of folks.
As far as this commission goes, has anybody been doing any homework to prepare for it, or do they just start out cold today?
Well, gee, that's hard to say. I don't know what each of the six members, the three Democrats and three Republicans, have been doing to prepare for this, but I think I'm pretty sure all of them have been getting briefed and by their own aides and so forth. They're going to hear today, supposedly from the Legislative Service Commission, the budget experts in that agency, and then maybe at later meetings they may hear from the Strickland administration budget officials and tax officials. But the legislature has its own bank of experts and financial experts, and that's who they want to hear from first, so that they do have the most up-to-date background from folks that they say they could trust.
Is this commission, is it goal to just plug this hole now, or is there a long-term aspect to it?
Well, I guess you'd get some folks arguing, hey, we've got to not just fill this hole, but put us on the road to a better economy later. But I think, heck, it's a big enough task just to fill the $4, $6, or $8 billion hole they've got. I mean, if they do that, and there's not a total revolt here by voters, I think they'll consider that they did a heck of a good job.
Well, how can there be a revolt by voters if they don't just start doing anything until after the election, right?
Well, I mean, it would be at the next election. Let's remember, this budget doesn't get put together. The deadline for getting this budget together, this is the next state budget that would take effect next July 1st.
Right.
So, I mean, this is just a lot of preliminary talking right now. And so it would be, I guess, voters in 2 years would take their wrath out at legislators if they didn't like the way the legislators solved this budget mess. But this is just a lot of preliminary talking. It's almost unprecedented that they're talking so early about the next state budget, but at least they're doing that because everybody, the liberals and conservatives, admit this is a huge hole.
Well, isn't this an unprecedented shortfall?
Yeah, I think you'd have to say it's an unprecedented shortfall, not only in its amount, but in its percentage. And let's remember, one reason we're in such a mess, in a way, for this next state budget is that the current state budget is built on, I don't know, $5, $6, $7, $8 billion of one-time money, a lot of it from the federal government, the federal bailout money. And so they knew when they put together the current state budget that this money probably wouldn't be reappearing again. I mean, some of it might be if they get a second bailout, but they're not expecting most of it to come back again. So they knew when they put together this last budget, and Republicans and conservatives especially complained when they put together the last budget, hey, once you pass this budget, you're really putting us into hot water when you guys try to come up with the next state budget, because this all this one-time money isn't going to be repeated, probably.
My guest is Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio. He's a State House correspondent, and we're talking about the looming state budget deficit. Looming is never a good word. How long – you said we have until the end – well, how long do we need to fill the gap? Does the deficit kick in after next – you know, when the next budget starts, or are we already accruing a deficit? How does that work?
No, we're not accruing a deficit now. The current state budget is somewhat in balance, and I mean, there have been some problems, but they think they can fix those short term. So we're about ready to start the second year of a 2-year budget, and then the new budget, this one that's the looming, the one that really has the mess, that would start July 1st.
Okay.
So you know, when we say there's a deficit, it's a projected deficit. This is all based on projections. I mean, if the economy would suddenly just start to soar in the next month or two or five, heck, maybe it wouldn't be an
$8
billion.
They'd start building iPads in Ohio, right?
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, we could get that. We could get it down to $2 or $3 or $4 billion. You know.
How do we put $8 billion or even $6 billion into perspective?
Well, maybe by talking about, well, what are some theoretical ways to fill that? Let's say you wanted to raise the state sales tax another penny on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
You could raise, I think, about $2.7 billion over the 2-year period. So again, this is a 2-year budget. So let's say we call it a $7 billion mess. You'd need to, if you wanted just to solve that with a sales tax hike, you'd have to raise the sales tax about 2.5 points.
Mm-hmm.
It's currently at 5.5%. The Columbus Dispatch did some kind of theoretical things the other day. It was a good way to illustrate it. They said, look, if you want to wipe out all 58,000 state workers, lay them all off tomorrow, you could save about $4 billion.
In just a year?
Over the 2-year period. Where they say, well, you could wipe out several agencies, mental health, developmental disabilities, the development department, youth services, veteran services. You could wipe those out, at least the tax funding for those dozen or so agencies. You'd save about $3.4 billion. So, you know, I think a lot of legislators, if you talk to them privately, say, look, we're probably, this thing is so deep that we're probably going to have to fill it with a little bit of both. Unpopular higher taxes and unpopular spending cuts.
Now, here's the kind of arcane reference of what the $56,000 question. What are the gubernatorial candidates saying?
Well, let's see. John Kasich, the Republican, has signed a no new taxes pledge, which basically says, I will oppose any move for higher taxes. This is kind of a national campaign that a conservative group tries to get local and state and federal office holders to sign, and he's signed it. So he's basically saying taxes are off the table as far as he's concerned. Governor Strickland is saying, well, he's not signing that pledge. He's not calling for a tax hike, but he says basically everything is on the table. Of course, he's the one leading this charge, though, going to the Fed, saying, please give us another federal bailout. And that's where you have Kasich kind of deriding that, saying it's terrible Ohioans and the governor are going to the feds with a tin cup begging for more federal cash. That's what got us into this mess in the first place. We shouldn't repeat that again. So a very stark contrast between those two.
Is it just a matter of what got us into this mess is just less revenue from our sources, from our tax sources, period? Or are there more expenses, too?
Well, yeah. Oh, more expenses. Medicaid is this, mm-hmm. you know, is what gobbles up the biggest chunk of the budget. That's free medical care for the poor and for folks in nursing homes, so that just keeps increasing. Mm-hmm. There were times it used to increase like 15% a year. Then they got it down, the increase down to 3 or 4%. Now, recently, I hear it's mushroomed back up to 6 or 7%. So that's a real tough one. The big problem here is if you put Medicaid down, which is tough to cut,
mm-hmm.
and education and higher education and prisons and property tax relief for businesses and homeowners, those are programs that just a lot of folks say, well, you can't cut any of those. Well, that's 85% of the state budget. So that's where you put yourself in a dilemma when you say, okay, we're going to solve this with spending cuts. Okay, fine. But now you got a tough question to answer. Where are you going to save $4, $6, or $8 billion with just spending cuts when you've got those big chunks that a lot of folks say are uncuttable, taking up most of the state budget? Of course, you might say, well, those shouldn't be untouchable. Maybe we'll find ways to cut Medicaid more. We'll find higher education will have to take a cut. Schools will have to take a cut. What's so sacrosanct about those? Some folks would say so. That's a, you know, that is a, they're all open for cuts.
Is a federal bailout even a possibility?
Well,
I suppose you can always say it's a possibility,
yeah,
but is it? What are the odds?
Well, gee, that's really tough. I don't cover the Fed, so I don't mm-hmm. have a real good sense. But I mean, Ohio isn't alone in. If Ohio was alone in this asking
right.
for a second bailout, I'd say the chances are zero. But the fact that so many other states are in a similar situation, and I'm sure are also pressuring the feds for a second bailout, that's where you get, I think, the possibility that, yeah, there could be another one. It might not be as big as the last time around, but it could certainly help. If you get another billion or two, at least that would take the edge off.
John Kasich has signed that no new pledges, no new taxes pledge and promised smaller government, but he says he won't really know what he needs to do until he's elected governor. Is that realistic? I mean, is that true that there's no way that someone in his position can make promises or can talk about what they would do in this kind of a case without actually being in the hot seat?
Well,
he can say it, but is it?
He doesn't want to say right now. If we try to press him, you don't want to have tax hikes. That's a legitimate public policy mm-hmm. position. But now you have to answer just as tough a question. What are you going to cut? And he doesn't want to answer that question right now. Now, of course, he's also on record as proposing, at least in the long term, phasing out the state income tax, which mm-hmm. would make the hole even bigger in the years to come, at least in the short term. He claims in the long term it would boost the economy and maybe get us out of this mess. But in the short term, it would mean even less state money coming in. So he'd have to make even more cuts. But he doesn't want to answer that before the election. And Governor Strickland doesn't want to answer that before the election either. He doesn't want to say, even though he might, he is keeping tax hikes on the table. He doesn't want to make a big deal out of that. Yes, I'm open to a tax hike, sure. But that's what he's saying when he says, you know, everything's on the table and I'm not going to sign a no new taxes pledge. So there's pluses and minuses to all, you know, everybody's stand here because just about all the options are unpopular.
Now, when you're talking about selling the lottery, what do you mean by that?
Well, I don't. It's a complex thing.
Who buys lotteries?
I don't claim to understand it all. But you remember in the last election, Ken Blackwell said, "Well, let's sell off the Turnpike."
Yeah, I remember
it's
that
kind of thing where you say basically we're going to sell off a state something that is always bringing in money in a gradual way, and we're going to sell it off to some private company that will agree to give us, you know, several billion dollars now. For the right to take in gradually millions for decades. So we're kind of selling off kind of our inheritance in a way mm-hmm. for some short-term cash. I don't know exactly how it would work, but of course we do know that in other states turnpikes have been sold off, and they've gotten some short-term billions of dollars in cash, but now they're not getting that trickling in of millions of dollars over decades. So I guess they're saying the same thing could theoretically happen with the state lottery. You could privatize it in some way, and whoever bought up the lottery would give us a lot of cash in a lump sum, but then they'd be the ones taking in the hundreds of millions every year in profits and so forth.
But they'd also be running it.
I assume they'd be running.
It's kind of like a privatization then.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Bill, we've run out of time for this segment. Thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate your help.
You're welcome.
Okay, that was Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio, State House Bureau. We're going to return with some folks who have some ideas about how to fix the budget in Ohio. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
What's the mood like there today?
What do you think? We're the first store in Ohio to sell a Powerball winning ticket.
Do you have any, by any chance, know who the winner is?
No, I don't. I just hope it's a good people and they do good things with it.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen online at WOSU.org. Currently 72 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a nice day with a high of 78. Clear skies tonight and a low of 54. More sunshine tomorrow and a high of 75. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the estimated $6 billion to $8 billion state budget deficit that kicks in just about a year from now. Joining us in a few minutes to talk about their recommendations will be John Honick of the Cleveland-based Nonprofit Center for Community Solutions. With us now is Barbara Benton of the Ohio Society of CPAs. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Just want to remind listeners, if you have an idea about how to an idea for the budget, a budget fix, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and post it there. If you email it, we don't get to it. I'll promise to post it on the Facebook page later today. Barbara, why the society, the Ohio Society of CPAs has said that they want the governor and the governor gubernatorial candidates and the legislature to start working on this problem now. As I was just talking with Bill Cohen from Ohio Public Radio, the conventional wisdom at this point is that they're just going to all wait until after the November elections. What difference does it make if they do it now or wait until after November?
Well, frankly, the pressure is that you can't just as we, you know, can in our home life, a business can't wait until the last minute. You need to prepare. You need to strategically think out how you're going to address your various problems. And what that would require, we believe, in Ohio is to do two things right away. One would be establish long-range strategic planning and financial planning, and then also to start conducting an aggressive series of performance audits to help identify efficiencies, streamlining, cost containment, you know, things along that line that would certainly help them when they do introduce the budget in the winter months.
The issue of streamlining, that's been around since, well, as long as I was covering the legislature, since, the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing that. They've had their blue ribbon commissions and that kind of thing to shrink state government, make it more efficient. That was one of the outcomes of that was the Ohio Jobs and Family Services combination of the Ohio Bureau of Employment Services and also Human Services. And there's disagreement over whether that's efficient or not. Well, that is a really long-term proposal, and it has never worked before.
Well, frankly, I think if you look around the country, you will see examples of many government entities at the state and local levels who are taking advantage of the opportunities to eliminate duplication of services, to save administrative costs, lots of different ways that can be addressed. Here in Ohio, it's already happening in some cases. For example, if you look at school districts, that is certainly a very sensitive topic with many voters, of course, because everybody wants local control, and we need to, make sure our kids have the education that we expect. But one example would be up in northeastern Ohio, in Orville and Rittman school districts. The superintendent of the Orville school district is now the superintendent also of the Rittman school district. By doing so, he's saving significant tax dollars. The treasurer will also be the same for both districts. They're sharing office equipment that's things like fingerprinting and, mm-hmm. Things that you don't need every day. They're just in that little area with those two districts and the limited amount of sharing that they're doing. They're saving $250,000 just without, and frankly, they said that they could even do more. When you look at the state of Maine, Ohio is not the only state dealing with this budget deficit. There are states all over the country. In Maine, as I just mentioned, with school districts, what they had done is said that the various local school districts can do whatever they want, But if they don't start streamlining, particularly where your administrative costs are concerned, then their carrot and stick approach said that we will only allocate you 98% instead of 100% of the funding that you're expecting from the state. In response, 25% of those districts consolidated. It's frankly a matter of choice. And in this budget situation that Ohio's facing, there are some really, really tough choices that are going to have to be made.
What do you mean by financial planning? I know what it means for an individual, but what does it mean for a state?
Well, for a state, what we're talking about, and first of all, let me set the stage by saying that when the CPA Society looked at this issue, we tried to treat the state of Ohio like a client. You know, a CPA mm-hmm. firm would treat a client. Okay. And with that, you look at a number of different things. And the big ones that you automatically look at when you're talking to a client in financial distress is, what cost can you contain or eliminate? What streamlining and efficiencies can you gain? What kind of long-range financial plan and strategic planning do you have in place? And what that does with that particular one is look at exactly where you are, how much money do you have? Going forward, what can you start implementing, and when would those savings take effect? It helps you plan ahead. And frankly, the state of Ohio does a number of these things, but what we're recommending is what Ohio do is to adopt a program like Florida has. In the state of Florida, just in the last few years, the voters down there adopted a constitutional amendment that requires the state of Florida to every year come up with a long-range financial plan that gets everybody on the same plate. There are no surprises. It takes into all kinds of factors. Certainly things that affect Florida don't affect us, like hurricanes. But, you know, they look at things like ballot initiatives that might impact state funding, different, unemployment, things that are coming that they mm-hmm. expect. Certainly the recession is something that they've been looking at, and when they expect things to get better or worse, frankly. Those are all things that ended up in one document, and they used not just the state officials, but they also took advantage of the knowledge in the private sector, and they brought in private sector experts who partnered with public sector experts to develop a really good plan that everybody can use. It was a public document, and it has helped down there. You know, certainly they're experiencing budget challenges just like we are, but at least there aren't surprises. They know right where they are, and that's what we hope the state of Ohio can do, is have a very clear understanding of where they are. Just like, you know, you said a few minutes ago with Bill Cohen, we don't even know what the number is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you need to know.
You said that you will that the society will neither endorse nor give campaign money to anyone who doesn't offer specific ideas about dealing with the budget shortfall. How much money are we talking here?
Well, first of all, that's not exactly what
okay.
we said. What we had said is that this our endorsement process has been going on for 14 years, mm-hmm. and the normal process always includes with incumbents a voting record. We look at their background, their experience, their qualifications, and so on. We survey them to find out their philosophical views on our key issues, and we look only at business issues. We don't look at social issues because we're a professional organization, and, you know, the other groups have their own areas that they look at. And then we look at input from local CPAs. In this case, because this is an unprecedented situation the state of Ohio is facing, mm-hmm. we're putting particular emphasis on exactly how candidates plan to address the huge budget deficit and what they're going to do to make Ohio economically competitive again. Because the goal is not only to, you know, get us through this, but to help us come out even better on the other end and ready to really compete with the other states and attract the businesses we need to employ Ohioans. So with that, what we said is it's simply not good enough to say, you know, their priorities are broad generalities like mm-hmm. creating jobs or cutting waste. You know, we want specific details
right.
on what areas are you willing to tackle, you know, because, frankly, in our view, everything needs to be on the table, every program, every benefit, every contract, even the virtual structure of the state. Not that we're saying that everything in our recommendations when I talk about recommendations, we had issued a series of recommendations back in November that we shared with the governor and with mm-hmm. a number of legislators. And part of that dealt with, what do we need to do? And we weren't saying all of these things must be implemented. And in fact, we looked at it from a 30,000-foot level. We didn't say specifically this program must be changed. What we said is these are all areas that need to be addressed because they are, frankly, ripe for reform. So with that, we want people to come into office who are candidates prepared to deal with it because they will only have 6 months. The new budget must be in place per the Constitution by July 1st. So we want people to be ready, and in terms of incumbents, we want to know what have you already done? What bills have you sponsored? What initiatives have you tackled, both in terms of addressing the budget deficit, but also looking at economic development?
Okay. Barbara Benton, Ohio Society of CPAs, we have to move on now, but I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Joining us now is John Hanek. He's with the Center for Community Solutions. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Appreciate it. Your new report is entitled Thinking the Unthinkable. What's unthinkable about it?
Well, what we do in the report is develop a scenario that we think is reasonable and balanced given sort of the political spectrum in the state and the needs of the state. And so the unthinkable part is getting people on all sides of the budget debate to sort of question their assumptions and, you know, move away from their comfort zone and think about what really has to be done to close a budget gap that is probably in the realm of $6 to $8 billion over the next biennium. So for some folks, that means thinking seriously about a tax increase. We've had rounds of budget cuts in the previous 2008-2009 budget. This budget started from a much lower level, at a level that really is, devastating a number of important social programs in the middle of a recession when they're most needed. And on the other side of the ledger, finding some sort of balance, as your last guest said, means reorganizing, maybe consolidating some programs, looking for efficiencies, and yes, probably some additional cuts. And so the scenario we had took a balanced approach and said let's raise, given all the cuts that have occurred recently, let's raise about two-thirds of a budget gap or fill two-thirds of a budget gap with some tax increases, reductions in basically tax subsidies or tax loopholes for special interest, and then the other one-third, let's think about all the efficiencies and any additional cuts that would be necessary. The basic point is here that there's got to be some compromise. There has to be a way for folks to meet somewhere in the middle in order to get this done. The legislature didn't get the last budget on time, and if we don't get people sort of moving off of their comfort levels, we're going to have another just a mess on our hands next summer with interim budgets and really failing to make choices.
It looks like the lawmakers at this point are going to avoid taking action on anything budgetary until after the election in November. Is that to our detriment? Are there things they could be doing now to help us start stockpiling money for this shortfall in the next 2 year cycle?
Well, with the with the revenue streams we have now, that and the recession continuing, it's very difficult to over the next fiscal year to stockpile any money. Mm-hmm. I think there's, in terms of them taking an action, there's some glimmer of hope that there's a budget commission comprised of three House members and three senators that will start meeting this summer.
Today.
Today. Mm-hmm. That's correct. First one is today. The next one's in July. To at least start taking a look at this issue. And I hope that, you know, the exercise is not just, you know, being done for
exercise.
just for exercise or just for show, basically, that there's actually an opportunity for all, you know, all sorts of groups and citizens to come forward and offer their, you know, their views about what should be done. You know, we were disappointed to, you know, to hear, you know, when we released our report, to hear that some members of the commission thought taxes should be completely off the table. And we have to recognize there's a pattern here in previous, we've gone through a number of these recessions. This one's particularly deep. Earlier in the decade, we had some major tax overhaul, which was basically a tax decrease in terms of the overall revenue to the state. And in previous recessions, there's always been a pattern of, you know, cutting the budget first, and then when you get to the bone, and mm-hmm. different people disagree about where that is, but I think we're there yet. We're there right now in a number of places. You know, you have to stop and take a look at tax increases to fill part of the gap. So we'll see whether this is, you know, done as for public consumption or whether it's, you know, a meaningful situation.
We have a caller right now. Don, you're on the air. You say look at the pensions of public employees. Why?
Well, I mean, when you look at where it costs the state so much to do business with these gold-plated retirement plans that are underfunded. I think state teachers are $40 billion. They got a hole that they got to fill, but we still give increases. Until we address that, I read the Sunday Dispatch article, and they didn't say anything about the employee cost of doing business. And first of all, I'm a very liberal Democrat. And I don't know how we can face, because the structural group, it costs so much to employ somebody under the current program.
Well, do state pensions have how do they fall into the state budget matrix?
Well, the state puts present dollars to pay pension benefits.
Right. Well, you have to have pensions, though, right?
Yeah,
you agree?
I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I am saying that they're too lucrative for what we get. It costs the state too much money when they hire an employee that after 20 or 25 or 30 years, we'll give them 80% of their money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long term we're using present dollars to subsidize that.
All right. Don, thank you. Thanks for your call. John, how are you in the plan you propose reframing the local government fund to both cut costs and assist local governments in achieving economies through collaboration and consolidation of services? How do you – it's already – talk about something that's been almost cut to the bone. How do you frame something that barely exists anymore?
Well, it does exist, and it's, you know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly in all these areas, you have to proceed carefully and think about options. You know, local governments do have some, you know, financial means of their own. Some of them are better financial shape than others. But our idea was basically, let's put some money on the table to incentivize some collaborations to reach some efficiencies. And sort of enable or encourage, I guess, is the best word, some cooperation among local jurisdictions. And some of them are doing it already. But I think you get some more widespread action out there if the state were actually encouraging this. Right now, it's the local government fund is a formula, you know, based largely on population.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in this sort of environment, the main point here is to take a look at that, you know, and figure out what are we getting for those dollars? Does the formula make sense? And maybe you'd look at it and say, well, you know, we can do some tinkering here or not. But, you know, again, it's a discretionary fund of the state. It's been around for a while, but that's the sort of thing that, you know, needs to be discussed in this kind of environment.
Okay, John Honick of the Center for Community Solutions. It's a Cleveland-based nonprofit social service research group that last week recommended a blend of cuts and taxes to fill the hole. John, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
I'm going to read real quickly an email from Kristen. She gave us a long list of suggestions. Thanks, Kristen, but we'll just give a few. The state offices should only be open 4 days a week. Closing the buildings would save some money on utilities. Also, raise the AC temperature and lower temperatures during winter. Legalize marijuana and tax it. And raise the driver's license fee. And then we have another email from a listener. I think there should be closer monitoring and follow-up on all tax increment financing deals and abatements granted to corporations. About 5 to 10 years ago, I remember NBC4 running a report which detailed how businesses had not lived up to their end of the deal. I think businesses must be held accountable, and I'd bet a lot of money and jobs are, quote-unquote, falling through the cracks. We're going to return in a few moments and talk about whether or not the City of Columbus City Council should be able to have meetings in secret. When we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here, and we'll hear about issues related to ending homelessness for families, veterans, and youth, including the Obama administration's new federal strategic plan to end homelessness. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820. And a sustaining membership is one that automatically renews, saving you and the station time and money. Give $20, $50, or $100 a month to show your continuous support for WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/sustainer and thank you for your support. It's 72 degrees currently in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high of 78. Clear skies tonight, a low of 54. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 75. More sunshine on Thursday and a high of 78. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We were just talking about the state budget and the problems, $6 to $8 billion looming budget deficit. I said if you have some ideas, give us a call or email us. Now just email us or go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook, and post those ideas there. We will include them. Now, Columbus City Council President Michael Mentel has appointed five people to review a potential change in the city charter that would allow City Council to conduct some of its business behind closed doors. Lawyer Larry James has been appointed to lead the commission. He's going to be with us in a few minutes to talk about how they'll tackle that job. In the meantime, Dispatch reporter and blogger Bob Vitale is with us now to talk about the circumstances surrounding the commission and why it was created. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning, Ann.
How are you doing?
Very good.
What spurred the creation of this commission?
Well, this all started in 2007. City Council had two vacancies. Two members had resigned. And they conducted their appointment process the same way they have for years. When Mayor Coleman was City Council President, he did it this way. Council presidents before him did it this way. Council would take applications from people, and then they'd interview their favorites in private. All seven council members would interview council applicants. They would curiously announce their choice before they ever voted on it in public. Bill Todd, who was a Republican running for mayor in 2007, called them out on this. The Republican Party threatened to sue. City Attorney Rick Pfeiffer, who's a Democrat, agreed with them that the city charter does not allow council to meet in private. Mike Mentel tried to change the process last year when there were two more council vacancies, and it just blew up. Two council members said that they were being kept out of the process. It was a more open process, according according to Mike, where council members conducted their own interviews. So they talked last year about, you know, that council needed to be able to do this in private, and this is the result. The Charter Review Commission will recommend by August whether to place this on the ballot in November.
What exactly would change in the city charter if voters approved of such a thing?
Well, right now the charter kind of contradicts itself. In one place it says that all meetings of city council and its committees are public. In another place, there's a passing reference to executive sessions. City attorneys in the past had interpreted that to mean there are executive sessions. Rick Pfeiffer, who's a stickler on open meetings and open records, said no, there are none. So it would allow city council to meet in private for the same reasons the Ohio Revised Code allows county boards,
school boards,
every other government body in Ohio to meet in private.
Now, what do other cities do? Other cities, you know, other big cities in Ohio, do most other cities have this, executive session option?
Cleveland's city charter is worded the exact same way Columbus is. So in Cleveland, everything is supposed to be open. In Cincinnati, it also is the same. It says that all its government meetings are open. The other seven big cities in Ohio in the top 10 all follow state law, which allows exceptions to open meetings.
What are the opponents of executive sessions saying is wrong with that?
Well, there's been no organized opponents yet. I think a lot of people have been critical. This is going to be hard to sell to voters. Right now, people are very cynical about government and very skeptical about government. So it's going to be tough to sell. You know, I think people want their government to be open and transparent.
Why appoint a commission? Why aren't they just proposing the change and letting folks vote on it?
I think the city charter itself
requires
this provision that a charter review commission is always appointed to look at changes in the charter.
Okay.
And it's a commission of citizens, so.
What kind of citizens? Who are they?
Well, Larry James is the chairman. He's a local lawyer. Hugh Dorian, the city auditor's on the commission. Fran Ryan, who's a former council member, is on the commission. And there is a city resident and also another lawyer.
How did they choose him? Do you know?
I think it was just Mike Mennel's choice and council.
Okay. Council's choice.
This commission is being appointed by council. The last one in the 1990s was appointed by Mayor Coleman, who was then council president, and Greg Lashutka, who was then mayor.
Okay. Bob Vitale of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate the primer.
You're very welcome.
Take care. Larry James, you're with us now.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good. Why is this needed now?
Well, the executive session provision has been around for 22 years, and it's just been awkward for a number of reasons. Attorney-client privilege, the selling of real estate. We've had a number of situations over the last 10 years where a council member or a public official has disclosed, unfortunately, to the public that real estate was for sale or contemplating for purchase, and it's just gone through the roof. So the question for Columbus and other cities is whether they want to create the right to go into executive session. I think as Bob indicated, of the 10 largest cities, 7 have the provision. If you look in Franklin County, you have all except Columbus and one other city who has the provision for executive session. I don't think it's a question of people doing business in private. It's a question of following state law and saying best practices suggest that government should have the same rights to protect the taxpayers' dollars when litigation, real estate practice, safety issues are in vogue. The council appointment process is just one of about a list of 7 that the state law contemplates for executive session.
As you move into these commission hearings and these commission meetings, what do you know about why Columbus, and I suppose Cleveland for that matter, didn't include that provision originally in their city charters? Did they not do it on purpose? Or
I think a lot of times when you're dealing with house cleaning measures and you're evolving going forward, it's something that you just didn't think about. And then as people have said, the Columbus Charter seems to have a conflict. It suggested that you do have executive session, but it depends on the interpretation from your city attorney, and that has political ramifications. So I think, to be crystal clear, so people are transparent, when is the process of executive session appropriate? Now, let me say this. In the 22-year historical review of executive sessions, we've seen no major litigation or cases. So that strongly suggests that government officials are not abusing this process.
I was going to say that people are very accustomed to having, particularly school boards, which do a lot of hiring and that kind of thing, do things in secret, behind closed doors, however you want to put it. But that's also raised some questions when employees have been dismissed by school boards and they've all agreed not to talk about it. That bothers the public a lot when they can't find out why was that person let go.
Well, I think the question you have, certain situations of when documents become public, if you're talking about settlement agreements and employment cases, that is a question, but that has nothing to do with executive sessions. And there is a, I would say that there's a strong debate whether that is appropriate when you're spending taxpayers' money and you have litigation resolved, whether, and you usually see that in education-related institutions,
right?
Not in government, other government-type policies, because the public has to, you have to come out and vote in public on any issue. They can't vote in executive session. They have to come out and voice and, you know, give their reasons.
Now, tell me about how the commission's going to operate. When are you going to meet, and what are you going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk about the historical perspective and get a background of what executive session means. And I think it's been mischaracterized because it's easy to say government's hiding something, they're meeting in private. It's executive session. We want to talk about, when you look at Ohio and you look at central Ohio, what is the growing trend? How long has it been? Has there been any problems? Is there reason for concern? And if there are, how do you address those concerns?
You said that issues like attorney-client privilege and real estate values and those sorts of things have been affected by open discussions on the topics.
Sure.
But one of the, when this all came to ahead was a few years ago when
Correct.
There was the question about the appointments for the replacements for the retiring or resigning city council members. And a lot of that was because people seem to be getting more savvy about how people resign from office. They kind of sometimes do it, or they appear to be very strategic about it when they do it. So that appointment has to be made. There's not enough time to elect somebody and you have to wait a long time. Yeah, there's a lot of politics involved, or at least that's how it's perceived.
Whether the voters approve this or not, you will still have that debate. Anytime you have an appointment process, people get philosophical and say, why shouldn't the person have to run as opposed to being appointed? So this is not going to solve that issue or make people happier or more miserable about whatever when you're talking about the process. You have seven Democrats right now. People say, you know, should Republicans be eligible to reside if they're the best candidates? This process will not solve that debate.
Former City Council President Matt Habash told Bob Vitale that he thought this is a good idea and that allowing private discussions about business negotiations and legal matters would give the council more input. How does that work? What does he mean by more input? Have you ever already addressed this and I just missed it?
No. I think the question is the way it works now, you can have two council members talking to each other. Anytime you get a third, or if those two council members were to talk about a business transaction, let's assume we were trying to bring some new enterprise here and there were confidential matters that could not be disclosed. Because you don't have executive session, council members are prohibited from talking to 2+1. So anytime you go after, you do that, you can't have a good, hearty debate on the terms and conditions of those type of issues.
614-292, but we really don't have a lot of time. So, Dempsis, you're it for the phone calls. You have about 30 seconds. What do you know?
I have a question and then a comment. My question is, I think you kind of hinted at it, is what is the importance or relevance of the executive session? I mean, especially with the salaries being paid by taxpayers and the public, I mean, most council sessions are advertised on the public access channel. I mean, what's the benefit of having these executive sessions?
Okay. You want to give us a quick recap there, Larry?
Yeah, it's very simple. Let's assume the city is being sued, and or there is a policy or security matter. If you do all of that discussion in public, you might as well say to the other side, here's my strategy, so to settle a case at a reasonable value is going to be compromised.
Larry, we're going to have to eventually, if I assume the commission's going to propose a change to the city charter, and eventually, though, the voters will have their say.
Correct.
Is the commission also charged with putting together a campaign to convince voters that this is a good idea?
Not at all. No, that's beyond our scope. We will simply make a recommendation of what we found to city council, and city council will make the decision whether they want to put it on the ballot.
And is that something that city council can spend money on to sell to the voters?
Not taxpayer dollars.
Okay.
They'll have to go out and raise the money. President Mental will have to put a campaign together and figure out how that's done. On any of these type of initiatives, it's non-taxpayer dollars.
Just like a school district when it wants to raise a levy or something like
Correct.
That. And how were the members of the commission chosen? Do you know?
President Mental and consultant with the other council member decided, who they wanted to be on this committee. I assume because I'd been, past safety director, I'd been past city assistant city attorney. So I assume that's why he came to me.
Do you know about the citizen appointment?
Yes, that's Patricia Powell.
Mm-hmm.
She's been active in a number of civic initiatives, and I assume that that's why she was selected. I know why Fran Ryan, she's been around government. She's been city clerk. She's been a council person. And Hugh Dorian is just good housekeeping.
Right. Well, Larry James, thanks for joining us. Larry James has been appointed to lead the commission to decide or to talk about whether council should be able to conduct some of its business in executive sessions. Larry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we've run out of time this hour. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.